Hello, I'm Wesley J. Smith, Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute, and you're listening to Brave New Bioethics. I'm often asked how I became an anti-euthanasia activist. Like most people on both sides of the issue, it began with a personal experience. That event occurred on November 1st, 1992, a Sunday. On that day, my friend Frances celebrated her 76th birthday by checking into a hotel, getting into bed, and swallowing a bottle of sleeping pills. She then pulled a plastic bag over her head and died. Frances's suicide was not an act born of impulse or momentary despair. She'd been planning it for years. Indeed, almost from the moment I met her in Los Angeles in 1998, she had spoken enthusiastically about how empowering and ennobling it would be for her to take her own life. In her mind's eye, she saw herself beginning to experience the debilitations of age. Rather than endure a slow decline and become a, quote, burden to her friends, Frances would say, quote, I'm going to hold a going-away party, close quote, where she hoped her many friends would surround her as she lay on a couch, tell her how much she meant to them, hold her hands and stroke her brow as she swallowed the drugs from her hoard of pills, as she called them, and where she would slowly and quietly transform from living friend to deeply treasured memory. Most of us who were among Frances's closest friends were appalled by her suicide fixation, and each in our own way tried to convince her not to do it. We told her repeatedly that we valued her presence among us. We tried to assure her that growing old did not make one less valuable as a human being, and that illness or disability did not make one a burden. We urged her to seek counseling, hoping that if she put as much energy and effort into living as she seemed to be putting into plans for dying, she could find renewed meaning and joy from a life that clearly did not satisfy her. Frances had a troubled life, the details of which I won't go into here, but it is worth noting that talk about her future suicide would wax during her more unhappy times and wane during the time she felt productive and useful. Surely no coincidence. At one point, we all became convinced that Frances wasn't just talking anymore, that she was really about to do it. Interventions were held. We pleaded, cajoled, doing everything we could think of to help her keep a firm grip on life, all to no avail. It would take a miracle, it seemed, to dissuade her. Then, a miracle of sorts did happen, but it was nothing supernatural. Her alimony was cut off. Suddenly, Frances had a cause. The suicide was forgotten as Frances headed for court on a full head of steam, acting as her own attorney to force resumption of her payments. Clearly, here was a woman who, despite all her romanticized talk of her warm and fuzzy deliverance, desperately needed a reason to live. Frances won, but the triumph did not satisfy her for long. As the glow of her court victory wore off, Frances again spoke of suicide. At about this time, she was diagnosed with lymphatic leukemia, which was treatable, but certainly upsetting. She developed a neuropathy from which she experienced a distressing burning sensation on her skin. And while she had no visible limp, she was also a candidate for a hip replacement. And underneath it all was the abiding sadness about her life's many disappointments. By this time, I had moved to San Francisco, so I had less personal contact with Frances than in previous years. Then one day, one of her best friends called, very upset, telling me Frances is planning to die next week on her birthday. I called Frances immediately. I implored her at least to see a psychiatrist before doing it. She refused, saying, he might give me a pill that would make me not want to kill myself. I was later told that she invited her friends in Los Angeles to her long-planned going-away party. All of her friends refused to attend. They loved her. They did not want her to kill herself, and they would not support this chosen action. Frances then told everyone the suicide was off, but she was lying. 2 days afterward, I and her other friends received a photocopied suicide note. In it, she spoke of herself as being, quote, in control, close quote, and stated that the act, quote, is not one of suicide. I consider that it is my final passage, close quote. Usually after a suicide, those who were close to the deceased person wonder why, grieve, and finally go on with their lives. But I had a queasy feeling that there was more to Frances's death than appeared on the surface. It was as if she had somehow been encouraged to pursue death. Yet, I knew her friends had all tried to persuade her to embrace life. I decided to investigate. Frances was one of the most organized women I have ever met. She'd kept a file on everything. So I called the executrix of her will and asked her to send me Frances' suicide file. A week later, it arrived. It wasn't very thick. There were some news clippings that put a positive spin on suicide and a smattering of poetry. But most of the material was from an organization I had paid scant attention to before, the Hemlock Society, which is now called Compassion and Choices. Specifically, Frances had collected several issues of the organization's newsletter, the Hemlock Quarterly. That these writings had a major influence on Frances, there can be little doubt. She had highlighted much of the text with a yellow marking pen. Several issues were dog-eared from frequent reading. As I read the material, my jaw dropped. The document seemed scurrilous to me, nothing less than pro-suicide propaganda extolling self-destruction as a morally correct and an empowering experience. Most of the newsletters had suicide proselytizing stories of warm and fuzzy successful suicides. The January 1988 issue of the Hemlock Quarterly caught my eye because it was especially worn from frequent reading. One of the stories inside, entitled A Peaceful Passing, signed A New Member in California, supposedly a grief counselor, told in glowing terms of the suicide of Sam, allegedly a terminal cancer patient. Frances had underscored these words from the story, quote, "Believe it or not, we laughed and giggled, and Sam seemed to relish the experience. I think for Sam it was finally taking control again after 10 years of being at the mercy of a disease and medical protocols demanded by that disease," close quote. Suicide promoted as uplifting, enjoyable fun. What is this, I wondered, some kind of weird death cult? Other articles in the same issue explained how to commit suicide. One provided a listing of the drugs that were good for suicide, describing their relative toxicity and the amount of each drug required to constitute a lethal dose. Frances had underscored the names of the drugs with the highest toxicity levels. Another instructed on the proper use of a plastic bag. Chills ran up my spine. It was as if I were reading an exact description of Frances's death. So closely had she followed these instructions. The more I thought about the Hemlock Society propaganda and its direct connection with Frances's death, the angrier I grew. Who were these people to push a pro-suicide message on the depressed and vulnerable, people looking desperately for some way to be in control of their unhappy lives? They didn't even know Frances. Yet they had given her the moral support to kill herself and taught her how to do it. It was infuriating. Frances always used to say that her special talent was helping people find their proper place in life. Ironically, her suicide did that for me. After her death, and largely because of the way she died, I immersed myself in the euthanasia issue, reading volumes of material pro and con, and began writing and speaking about assisted suicide. I began a close association that continues to this day with the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, an organization dedicated to raising awareness of the dangers inherent in legitimizing and legalizing euthanasia and assisted suicide. I became acquainted with an international network of concerned people who share my views and who help me in my work as I help them. In short, I became an activist. The first piece I ever wrote about euthanasia was published in the June 28, 1993 issue of Newsweek. Here, in part, is what I said. Of great concern to me is the moral trickle-down effect that could result should society ever come to agree with Frances that assisted suicide is a proper way out. Life is action and reaction, the proverbial pebble thrown into a pond. We don't get to Brave New World in one giant leap. Rather, the descent to depravity is reached by small steps. First, suicide is promoted as a virtue. Vulnerable people like Frances become early casualties. Then follows mercy killing of the terminally ill. From there, it is a hop, skip, and a jump to killing people who don't have a good, quote, quality of life, perhaps the prospect of organ harvesting thrown in as a plum to society. That was more than 10 years ago, and that's still my opinion. I'm Wesley J. Smith. Thanks for listening.